I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A slowed-down video of Nancy Pelosi that made her sound and look drunk went viral, helped in part by Facebook, YouTube, and President Trump, who retweeted it. This is just a recent example of the kind of mass disinformation that's been making the rounds on the internet, including something called deep fakes, using technology to fake a video or audio to make someone say something they never said, to literally put words in their mouth. We asked Samantha Cole, reporter for Vice's Motherboard, to explain how this works and whether or not we should be worried about deep fakes, and she joined us by Skype. Samantha Cole, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Nice to be here.
Describe how deepfakes are made.
Sure. So deepfakes are made using an algorithm that takes lots of pictures of someone and turns that into a video of them doing something they never did. Deepfakes came to light in around 2017, so it's been a couple of years since they kind of came to the public eye. But since then, they've gotten a lot better. People are using fewer and fewer source images to make them, and they're being made faster. So it's been really interesting to see that progression.
And when we looked at the video of Nancy Pelosi, is that a deep fake?
No, that's just a slowed down video.
Okay,
that's,
fair enough.
Took a video and slowed it way down to make her look a little drunk.
Deepfake seems to have its roots in pornography. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so we found deepfakes on Reddit, like I said, in 2017. So back then it was being used by people who were just said they were just practicing a hobby by taking pictures of women without their consent and putting their faces on porn videos. So it would be celebrities like Scarlett Johansson and Gal Gadot put on porn videos that made them look like they were having sex. So that's where deepfakes kind of began.
And what is deepfakes? Where does that word come from?
Deepfakes is the name of the Reddit user who was posting these videos and made this algorithm. So it's a combination of deep, like deep learning, which is a concept of machine learning, and fakes, so obviously fake videos.
So speaking of machines, so are machines doing this now or still people involved?
There are still people involved. There are people involved in all kinds of AI. So anytime you hear someone talking about AI, there are people behind that. You have to have collected a data set of images, which a person does or runs another algorithm to collect them. And then they put those together and kind of lets it train. And then the result you get is the fake video.
So for instance, just so people understand, so it would be taking multiple images of, let's say, my face or your face?
Yeah, so they use celebrities at first because, of course, there are tons of videos and images of celebrities available out there. And at first, you needed thousands to do this. And now they're coming up with algorithms that you really only need one, as little as one, to make a video that's fake. But yeah, you could use, if you have tons of selfies available to someone, you could use the algorithms to make a deep fake of yourself. Or someone can make one of you if they had access to like hundreds of your selfies. And in some cases, as few as like one or eight would do it if you had a really good algorithm that could run it.
Oh, so a really good algorithm means I just need a couple of images and then I can do my deep fake?
Yeah, basically. I mean, those are ones that are coming out of like research institutions. So it's not as easy to do. It's not easy at all to do with that few. But it's places like Stanford and MIT and places that are using, exploring deepfakes to try to figure out how to detect them. So they have the really good computers, basically, to run this and to make the ones out of few images. So
we were looking at some of these images where you've got people saying things they never said. I mean, to be honest with you, I think a careful viewer can see that this is a fake. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of status of where it is these days?
Yeah, I mean, someone looking carefully could tell it was fake, especially when you're given it and you know already that it's fake. You kind of pick out the irregularities in facial movements and say, oh, this is not quite right. It's not that good yet, but if you saw it kind of in passing on a Twitter feed or on Facebook, like with the Nancy Pelosi video, you could hit share immediately and say, oh my God, this is crazy. Just with a little bit of context in that video, someone telling you what to believe basically reaffirms your biases and gets it to spread virally, which is what we saw with the Pelosi video, which wasn't even a deep fake, like we already discussed.
But the fact that it was shared, there are going to be enough people that are going to look at it and say, oh my gosh, Nancy Pelosi's drunk.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you could scroll by it and not even play the video and say, oh, wow, that's crazy. You know, and just believe it just from a glance, which is what a lot of people probably did with that one.
I was reading some of your articles in preparation for the show today, and you said one of the ways to detect whether something is real or not is looking at eye blinks. Can you flesh that out for us?
Sure. Yeah. So that's one of the ways that scientists and researchers have kind of found that a lot of these deepfakes are a little bit off. So they're using algorithms, again, to kind of look at these videos and say what's inconsistent to how natural movements work. So eye blinking is one of those things that we kind of know how people do it naturally. And if it's fake, it's easy to spot. And that makes it kind of uncanny. So, I mean, in the Zuckerberg video, which I'm sure we'll get to, he's blinking in that video. So it's not that they don't blink. It's that machines can kind of scan it and say, okay, this is fake because they're not blinking at the rate that humans do. But yeah, from just kind of the naked eye, I mean, he's blinking in that video. So you could say, oh wow, it's real. It's not fake because he blinks clearly, but a lot of these do. So yeah, it's tricky. It's something that researchers are definitely trying to tease out a little more.
As the expertise, the technology moves ahead, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, for every solution people find to detecting deepfakes, they get better. So it's a bit of a cat and mouse game.
Is it also a form of special effects in a way?
Yeah, I mean, we saw in one of the recent Star Wars movies that they recreated Princess Leia, like,
right.
In with a deepfake, essentially.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
Yeah, that was a deepfake. We didn't have the word for it yet, but special effects in Hollywood have been doing it with very good results. Or, you know, I mean, she still looked a little off, but
close enough.
It was pretty good. And yeah, Hollywood's been doing it for years, but just seeing people do it kind of in their own computers, like in their own backyards, essentially. Is what's really interesting and kind of pushing it forward.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Samantha Cole, reporter for Vice's Motherboard, the first of two guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about something called deep fakes. If you want to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Samantha, you wrote something in Vice, and I just want to quote it here. You say the real threat facing society when it comes to video manipulation isn't widely accessible technology or the ability to alter someone's image in convincing ways. It's that people are gullible, and it takes hardly any editing at all to make someone believe that what they want to believe. Is that really the heart of what we're talking about?
I think so. I mean, I've kind of said in the past and in that article, which was about the Nancy Pelosi video,
right.
It's not so much that the technology is good or that that we have these super realistic videos anymore, which is definitely scary. I mean, it's definitely frightening, but it's this notion that nothing is real. And if nothing is real, then everything is real and vice versa. It's definitely something that we're kind of wrestling with now as we battle fake news and the widespread of misinformation. It's a matter of confirmation bias. It's affirming things that you want to believe already. If you don't like Nancy Pelosi, you will love a video of her drunk on a stage. That's just kind of the way that humans are operating now in this world of social media. So, yeah, that's the real threat, in my opinion.
Is another real threat that a president or the leader of a country could, through deep fakes, declare war on another country?
Sure. I mean, that's been kind of the grabby part of all of this, we have a president who's retweeting or spreading misinformation himself. I think that That's a far off possibility. It's definitely an interesting thought experiment. It's definitely a horrifying thought, but I think that at this point we are kind of on hyper alert for this kind of thing. So I'm not sure it would really truly happen, but you know, I say this every time I say it might not happen, that I could eat this one day as we're as we're going.
Can't say that anymore, I think.
Who knows? Yeah, you really can't anymore. So yeah.
Well, you also say that, and perhaps this is kind of segueing from what you just said there, which is that in many ways deepfakes have been used more to target women, which gets us back, I guess, to the pornography part of this story.
Yeah, definitely. That was the roots of deepfakes. That hasn't gone away. We saw a journalist in India have severe harassment and threats made against her for a deepfake that someone made of her because they didn't like her reporting. That's the heart of the issue here is body autonomy and consent and what we own of our own likenesses. Celebrities have a lot more power in that respect because they can sue for, the ownership of their own likenesses. So the one that's of Kim Kardashian that was made by the same person who made the Zuckerberg one, I mean, I don't expect that to be up for long because Kim Kardashian could tell them to take it down because that's her likeness. But the regular person doesn't have that power. So that's also one really frightening aspect is, how this is being used against just individuals.
You mentioned the cat and mouse game. I mean, we're almost out of time here, but how do you police something like this? Or can you?
That's kind of what we're dealing with now. We're trying to figure that out. I think that like a legal expert could speak to this better than I could, but just from my own reporting and research, there's not a lot to be done about this. Sometimes once a video is out there that is of you that you want down, it spreads like wildfire. Mm-hmm. And the more that you say, this isn't me, this is fake, this is not real, you're boosting it and you're kind of showing it to the world more. There aren't good enough rules and laws around revenge porn on platforms or legally. So a lot of the times there's just not a lot of recourse when this kind of thing happens.
I guess, except staying off the internet, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that, but it's that's impossible these days. So I don't think it's up to the individuals to say, you know, don't take selfies. I think it's up to the platforms and legislators to catch up with this technology.
Well, Samantha Cole, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And she's a reporter for Vice's Motherboard. Reporter for Vice's Motherboard. And we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be talking with Sophie Rosenfeld. She's got a new book titled Democracy and Truth. She says there's always been an argument about truth in a democracy. We will carry on this conversation, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were just talking about something called deep fakes. These are videos and audio tapes that are doctored to make people say things they never said, to literally put words in their mouth. We live in a world that feels bathed in fakery, conspiracy theories, misinformation, misleading claims, even lies, driven in part by the reach, speed, and anonymity of the internet. President Trump, it seems, has taken this to new levels. The Washington Post just concluded that as of June 7th, the president has made 10,796 false and misleading claims or misleading claims since in office, and that's according to the paper's fact-checker database. Our guest, Sophia Rosenfeld, says that democracies have always struggled with and argued about what is true. Her new book, Democracy and Truth, looks at the inherent tension in democracies between the elite and the masses over accepted and shared truths. In fact, she writes that constant debate about what is true is at the heart of a democracy. She looks at the 18th and 19th centuries, the ages of revolution and enlightenment, to draw lessons for today. Sophia Rosenfeld is the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania and joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You were listening in as I was talking with our other guests about deep fakes. How does what she said fit into your thesis?
Yeah, deep fake seems to me just another step in the direction towards a world in which we're kind of awash in misinformation and disinformation. And it's interesting because she suggested that one risk is that people take these completely fake videos to be real. The other, I suppose, is that people don't know what to believe is real or isn't real and sort of give up on making any distinctions between them. They sort of don't believe them, but they don't not believe them either.
Well, I wonder, picking up on that, whether you think apathy is a greater threat to truth than fakery.
They're both threats in different ways. This phenomenon that keeps getting talked about are we post-truth, seems to be about not just are there more lies out there than there used to be, but are we, in a sense, apathetic about them, not really as worried about what's true and what's not, decided that truth is more in the eye of the beholder, that if it feels right in some way, good enough. I think it's a bit of an exaggeration. I don't think we've lost any moral compass. All this fact-checking, for instance, that you just alluded to, suggests that we really do, most of us, have some kind of stake in trying to figure out what's true and what's not. But it might have gotten a lot harder, and these deep fakes sound like it's going to make it harder still.
Well, I think even interpersonally, to be lied to or to be told untruths is such a personal affront.
Yeah. The interesting thing about truth is that they're sort of two senses of it. One is that it's the opposite of lies. And so when somebody lies to you, it's a kind of moral offense. It's an offense against your trust, your relation to the person. The opposite of truth, though, is sometimes error or unsubstantiated belief, which is really about knowledge. And that's less a kind of personal violation and more what you would call an epistemological crime of sorts. It's passing off as true what we know to be illegitimate in some way as factual knowledge.
You know, reading your book, I was thinking of Kim Jong-un. He's been in the news today, of course, or these days, I should say. And listening to an interview, actually, about him on Fresh Air yesterday, the author of the biography of Kim Jong-un talked about in North Korea, there are speakers in everyone's house. And in a sense, whatever the government says, or perhaps whatever Kim Jong-un says or believes that day is fed into everywhere people live so that they hear this truth from their dear leader. And then thinking about a democracy or a country like America that has free speech where people can say the most extraordinary and offensive things, and they have a right to do that.
Yes, that's the amazing thing about democracy in some ways, is that it's a really messy business, because the one thing that really distinguishes democracies is, on the one hand, a commitment to truth, but on the other hand, no commitment to exactly where it's going to come from. So there's no official method for getting to truth. There's no official spokesperson. There's no cleric or president or king or even an institution that tells us what's true. So the end result is messy because it involves lots of different voices battling it out. And we tend to think that's the best way to get there. But it's not. It's certainly not neat. On the other hand, what you report from North Korea,
yeah, we don't want that.
Is might be a lot less appealing.
But it takes away the sort of anxiety of knowing,
yes,
of believing. I mean, that, you know, if you're fed the so-called truth, then I would think your life in weird ways is less complicated or perhaps even less anxious. Obviously, there's a price for something like that. But just thinking about how we just argue about things all the time.
Yeah, we're in a particularly contentious moment, though I think democracy is always contentious. But we are in a particularly contentious moment where we can barely agree even on sort of factual questions. Not just are we having disagreements about opinions, but there seems to be very little consensus about things that you might say, well, that should be the sort of groundwork, like unemployment's up or unemployment's down. Well, then we'll debate what a labor policy should look like. But if we can't even agree whether unemployment's up or down, it's hard to start a conversation at all. On the other hand, in really authoritarian states, I think one risk is not just that everybody believes a single truth that might be wrong. It's also that people can become entirely cynical and simply detach. And it's possible also that North Koreans, they could be, in a sense, completely brainwashed.
Sure.
But the other possibility might be that they absolutely are aware this is a kind of official truth, but not anything really true. And they simply lead private lives that are unrelated to the official word they get every day.
I do want to talk about George Washington, who you quote in here, but I do want to first talk about President Trump. And you write an interesting thing. You say, in throwing over the social niceties and rejecting the euphemistic language of the educated establishment, otherwise known as political correctness, it looks to many people like he is actually telling it like it is, whether what he is saying is verifiable or not. And I thought that was an interesting commentary on, I mean, all presidents have lied to us. I mean, that must be said, but I think it must also be said that this president has really taken it to uncharted territories. How do you see President Trump then?
There was a fascinating statistic right before the last election in which it was, I think it was already abundantly clear, made clear by every major media outlet, that President Trump had a long history basically as a liar, that he wasn't a guy who told things as they were. He exaggerated. He made things up. He made stuff up about himself, about other people. And, of course, this has continued. On the other hand, it turned out many people thought of him as a truth teller. And for many of us, myself included, that seemed kind of puzzling. How could a guy who's been known to lie, the evidence often points in exactly the wrong direction. He says he had the biggest crowd ever when he was inaugurated, and then you look at the pictures and there's no one there. You know, it's sort of obvious. But truth is an odd term, because for some people, he was a truth teller for a different reason. It wasn't that it was empirically, verifiably true that what he said, but he said what was really on his mind, that he seemed to cut through the, for lack of a better word, bullshit. He didn't kind of use fancy words. He didn't beat around the bush. He just came out and said what was on his mind. And some people obviously felt that was a kind of refreshing version of truth. And it tells us something about how even when we're talking about truth, one person's truth is another person's lie, right?
Well, it's interesting. I think it was Patrick Moynihan who said famously, you know, everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but not his own facts. But it seems as if we're still sort of struggling about facts, about how many people were at Obama's inauguration versus Trump's inauguration. Or, I mean, I could go on and on and on from there.
So I think it's partly an effect of the sort of, in some ways, the positive democratization of knowledge. But the opposite side is that there are not very many gatekeepers anymore. We don't really agree that there's a set number of institutions that we might all believe, you know, sort of NBC News at night, or even congressional reports, or the Center for Disease Control. I mean, you can name all sorts of institutions that you might say are as close to the last word as we can get on factual content. I think the proliferation of sources and the fact that you go online and you can find thousands of different opinions and facts and information, nobody's paying that much attention to where it all comes from, suggests that facts are maybe just as slippery as opinions, that they're up for grabs.
Well, I'm old enough to remember Walter Cronkite, and watching him on television, he would end his broadcast, and that's the way it is.
Right.
You know, that's the truth from Walter Cronkite.
The New York Times, you know, has been sort of trying to reclaim this mantle as lots of big full-page ads about nothing but the truth. And I think the Washington Post has sort of followed suit. But I'm not sure that aside from its own segment of readers, that the general public is really convinced that if you want all truths, you go to the New York Times. That's now a niche position rather than perhaps the overall opinion of the American population.
And that's Sophia Rosenfeld. We're talking about her new book. It's called Democracy and Truth, A Short History. And she's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. You can join our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. What is true? That's what we're talking about on the show today. Let me quote George Washington. You quote him in your book. This was 1796, the end of his presidency. He was complaining about, I guess, the newspapers, the gazettes of the time, where he said, quote, "Teemed with all the invective that disappointment, ignorance of facts, and malicious falsehoods could invent to misrepresent my politics and affections, to wound my reputation and feelings, and to weaken, if not entirely destroy, the confidence that you, the public, have been pleased to repose in me." Complaining about the kind of coverage that he got as the first president of the United States. What does that tell us?
So I think it's important to keep in mind that it wasn't as if news was something objective until 3 years ago, or maybe even the 2005 and the beginning of social media. The news in the United States and in democracies in general, precisely because it isn't an official state organ, has always been highly politicized. And Philadelphia is a great example. The earliest newspapers in Philadelphia were filled with invective and nasty attacks. If you read them today, they still make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. They're sort of so nasty about each other. They had to compete in a commercial sphere. They had to sell papers, so they had to get attention. And they were political. They pushed explicit partisan positions. And just about every president has complained about being really unfairly treated by the media. It's really only by the late 19th century, so, you know, a little more than 100 years ago, that the idea of objective news reporting really came into being. It's a late development, this idea that of sort of nothing but the facts and separating the editorial content very specifically from the reportage that we're now used to in some venues, though that maybe those lines are now disappearing again. That's an open question. But I think it should remind us at least that the state of democracy has always involved a lot of fighting about what's true as well as what should be done.
Would it be easier for us as a democracy, as a democratic country, to have more consensus about what the truth is, about, let's say, climate change or income inequality? These are sort of abstract, right. Some less than others. But if we all just agreed, income inequality is a serious problem and we want to solve it. If we all believe that and we thought that was true, would we be better off as a country?
So I think it is important that consensus be loose consensus. We never really want to create a state in which there's 100% certainty about everything, because a certain amount of skepticism is important in democracies, that we take official truths and continue to question them. On the other hand, without even a loose consensus, it's really hard to build policy. So take the example of climate change. There seems to be pretty overwhelming consensus. It doesn't mean every scientist, but almost all scientists seem to suggest the planet is warming and it's being caused by human activity. The details may be somewhat up for grabs. And of course, what to do about it is certainly up for grabs. But if we can't even get to a point where we sort of say, let's say this is our best guess, we're not 100% sure, but this is where most informed voices are leading us to, then it's really hard to imagine how we begin to tackle climate change as an issue. I think much of the dysfunction of politics today comes from the fact that there's so little kind of ground-level, loose acceptance of certain kinds of truths. And again, I don't mean things being set in stone, but right. I mean a kind of working platform that says, to the best of our knowledge at present, most of us have concluded that climate change is a real thing. Now what do we do?
Well, it raises the question, I'm always hesitant to use the word elite, but let's use it anyway, which is people, I guess, with knowledge and power who make decisions and define policies. You describe it, the sort of disconnection, I guess, between the so-called elites and everybody else when it comes to, I guess, either pronouncements or policies or what is true or what is not.
It's a very tricky question because, of course, we both need experts, as they come to be known in the 19th century, and specialists. Right. But democracies are set up so that experts don't get the last word either, right? We vote after we've heard expert opinion. Ordinary people weigh in all the time in all kinds of different formats. The internet has helped in many ways. Ordinary people weigh in on conversations. In an ideal democracy, I suppose, which has never really existed. We never had one, but if we were to imagine an ideal, there'd be a kind of steady back and forth between people with certain kinds of high levels of information, which would be different kinds of specialists in different areas, and ordinary people. And they would both be sort of listening to each other and responding, and that kind of low-level consensus I was referring to a moment ago would sort of emerge from this messy business of going back and forth between them. A dangerous situation is when the opposite happens, when experts are either entirely ignored and the only voice is sort of you know, it didn't snow in my town, so there is no global warming kind of perspective, or the other way around, when experts cut themselves off from the people and believe they have the kind of monopoly on the truth. And that's a danger, too.
The idea of living in these separate worlds, I guess, or,
yes.
or not, there's so little crossover that there's no conversation, I guess.
Experts can be wrong, too. I mean, they can believe their own hype. They can fail to talk to enough people. They can be out of touch with sort of lived everyday experience. So one of the geniuses of sort of early democracy as it emerges is this idea of a back and forth between them. But when either side tries to have a kind of claim the truth as their sole property, I think we do run into some serious difficulties.
I forget who said this, but an expert is a fool from another town. I don't know.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah,
right.
I can't. I'm not sure who to credit that to, but it always stayed with me because it just takes them a little bit off their pedestal.
There are always famous examples of, you know, the kind of classic example. I don't even know how true it is. It's always something like somebody sitting in Geneva or Brussels trying to imagine water policies for some town in Africa without ever having asked anybody. What do you do with the water? Who gets it? How much do you need a day?
Well, let's take that. Let's take a short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. And that's Sophia Rosenfeld, our guest. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She's got a new book. It's titled Democracy and Truth. It doesn't get more highfalutin than that. A short history. We're talking about how we arrive at some of these truths, how we argue about truths in a democracy, why that is probably good for a democracy. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with the University of Pennsylvania's Sophia Rosenfeld, author of a new book titled Democracy and Truth. She writes, there's always been an argument about truth in a democracy, a tension between these so-called trusted experts and the so-called wisdom of the crowd. We're talking about what history can tell us about our current climate of things like conspiracy theories and fake videos, lies, misleading claims, all things that we talk about on Radio Times. And again, you can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Seems you're also saying that in order to be a vibrant democracy, we need to be able to argue about these things that we disagree about, and to argue, to be a good arguer, I guess, is the question I'm asking, and whether you think the level of discourse and argument in this country is of a high enough caliber.
That's an interesting question. Caliber, yeah. The one problem at the moment may be that the arguments have gotten so vituperative, that there's so much anger. Because a good argument should be vigorous,
yeah.
And disagreement's important. I mean, we don't want there to be a single party, for instance, in the United States. There might be even maybe more parties would be better. But the level of hostility has risen in a way that makes it really hard to have kind of meaningful debates at the moment. So I'm not sure whether it's really about the caliber as much as the tone sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that might be an effect. Of course, as you noted, George Washington was worried about the same thing. But I think that the internet has exacerbated the problem, the sort of anonymity, the culture of trolling and attacks, has a little bit poisoned the level of conversation. I don't think the internet did it by itself. I mean, talk radio has had an important role, and that preceded social media. So there are other developments one can point to. But we're at a nasty moment for argumentation.
Well, you mentioned the internet. I'm thinking, I mean, these are just the most sort of horrible conspiracy theories about so-called Pizzagate or, you know, crisis actors or... To me, the one that just is so revolting is that the Sandy Hook massacre in Connecticut was faked. There are people who believe that. And we were talking with our first guest about sort of a gullible public. But this is something even beyond that, that you can believe that you can believe that grieving parents are lying about their dead children.
It is terrifying. That one gets me particularly, too, because it seems not just so misguided, but so kind of evil to blame parents in some way in this tragic situation. There have always been conspiracy theories, too, and that, and I don't mean to sound like a broken record here, but the interesting thing is how they've gone mainstream. So people have always disbelieved all sorts of phenomena. We still have a flat Earth society, for goodness sake. You know, and that's been it's been a while since we've been, most of us have been convinced that the Earth is round. But the Sandy Hook story, for instance, that's gotten mainstream attention. And one problem is that mainstream media end up amplifying those stories. They don't quite mean to. In many cases, they're trying to debunk them. But every time they call attention to them, they move up in our feeds and our search engines prioritize them. And we all know a lot about what should be really fringe stories in some way and belonging to really fringe groups. And we haven't really figured out, the same way Samantha Cole was talking about how we haven't really figured out technology to detect deep fakes.
Right.
We haven't really figured out a way to debunk conspiracy theories that doesn't promote them.
Well, that's so interesting. We've done a couple of shows dealing with that same problem, and someone came up with this idea of a truth sandwich. So this is something you would say on the air. So you say what is true, you say what is false, and then you follow up with what is true, so that you put the false between these two, you know, pieces of bread, so to speak, as the kind of truth sandwich, thinking that that might convince people about what is actually true. I'd be curious just trying that out on you, what you think.
That's an interesting. I hadn't heard that expression before, and I like the idea. I do think it's very important for all kinds of media outlets, and especially public media outlets, to put energy into pointing out what's really just patently wrong. The kind of fact-checking work being done by so many different organizations I admire greatly. The problem may be, though, one of audience, because the same people who are unlikely to be convinced are the same people who are, in a sense, not listening to the outlets that are doing all this truth detection work. The harder question is sort of not how to persuade your own existing audience. It's how, I think, to reach audiences for whom, say, Breitbart is a good source of daily information.
That's that confirmation bias thing.
Yes, absolutely.
We all do this. We seek out information that tells us what we believe is true.
Right, we do. And people on the left or the right are really not immune from it. This may be a moment in which distrust of the mainstream seems to be dominant on the right. But if we go back to the Vietnam War, we'd find exactly the opposite, that the people most likely to distrust official information would have been on the left. It's not built into right or left-wing politics, this distrust of the establishment. But because I think the market is segmented so much, everybody can really just go now where they want to find the kind of information they want to find.
Well, think about the institutions that have failed. I'm thinking of, you know, religious institutions, the clergy abuse with the Catholic Church. Apparently in Ireland, you know, most of the churches on Sunday are empty because people have been so shocked and horrified about what the church has done. I don't want to beat up on the church, the press as well, universities, the government. I mean, these institutions that we depend on have had to deal with some of this dark stuff.
Right. Institutions are not blameless in this story. It's not as if we have sort of pristine institutions that have been assaulted from outside. But it's easier now to do your own journalism, say, or to find information bypassing libraries or bypassing universities. And that has its certainly positive aspects, but the downside of that has been the sort of proliferation of truths, many of which, you started with the conspiracy theories, are really not true.
Right, exactly. Louise says, if a person feels that God is on their side when it comes to some of these issues of truth, it's impossible to convince them that the other side is right. I mean, there's some conversations just cannot be had, or some arguments can't be had.
So that's a really interesting problem. And that, too, has a kind of long history, because precisely as we've never said there's one place to look for truth, we've never really agreed there's one method for getting there either. Experts tend to use kind of university-based methods rooted in empirical study and in reason. But there's also a long tradition of a kind of more populist truth that says, I know things because that's what it's felt like to me, either or faith tells me, or I live my life, I have daily experiences, I know what I know from that. And those aren't necessarily illegitimate ways of arriving at truth, but they're different ones. And if you're talking out of different ways of getting at truth, I think your caller's absolutely right that that often leads to a kind of dead end.
Let me just give out a couple of different ways to join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about democracy and truth with our guest, Sophia Rosenfeld. That's the title of her new book. So you look at the 18th century, the 19th century, the age of enlightenment, the age of revolution. Are there lessons that we can apply from those times to today?
I do believe that it's important to have a deeper perspective than one that says that all of this is a product of the last 10 years and the explosion of social media. Certainly some new factors are really vital. I mentioned talk radio, for instance, and Facebook, YouTube. But I don't think just looking at sort of technical fixes, which would suggest something about that this is all a kind of product of the computer age, gets us really to the heart of the matter. So to my mind, we have to know a little bit about how this all happened before we can start thinking about what do we do? And the what do we do part is really hard.
Sure.
So what do we do that's in the smallest scale? We've been talking about certain things, this truth sandwich idea, for instance, fact-checking. At the macro level, we'd have to think really big. In other words, we'd have to say something like, why do we all feel we're living in such different worlds? What kinds of vast inequalities are in education and wealth and opportunities are producing a world, but also just even a nation, in which people see the world so radically differently? Those, and in between is a whole sphere of kind of medium-term solutions, I would think of them as, some of which are institutional and some of which might be legal, about certain legal changes mm-hmm. that could happen. None of them are going to be easy fixes, though. And I think it's important that they all build on this longstanding commitment to pluralism, which is to say that we don't want to get rid of the idea of multiple voices. We don't want to get rid of the idea of the importance of skepticism about official truth. But there still needs to be some way to help moderate the conversation in some way, to help people determine, how can I know what to believe?
But are you saying that perhaps if we were a better democracy where the promise of the founders was more real in people's lives, where you could get ahead, where there wasn't income inequality, where there wasn't discrimination, where we didn't have this gigantic gap between the very rich and the very poor in this country. If we did a better job dealing with that, would we be more comfortable with truths, or would we be able to come together on some truths?
I do think we would have an easier time reaching at least at this low-level consensus position that I was talking about, which isn't truth, doesn't mean agreement about everything. It means just a few assumptions that we share that lets us then build policies and try to improve the world. To get to that consensus, I do think we need more common experience, whether mm-hmm. That's really hard to imagine in a world in which we don't all go to school together, we don't have the same experiences, we live in totally different economic realms at the moment. I think that these are not totally unconnected phenomena. So that's where, for instance, I'm a great supporter of fact-checking efforts, for instance, but I don't think they're going to sort of solve the problem by themselves.
Do you think there's a democracy that does a better job with truth than America?
So that's a really tough question.
I know.
I do think there's some promising things happening in Europe on the legislative front that are a little different than the U.S., where the U.S. is so committed to a realm of kind of absolute free speech and this idea of a marketplace of ideas that may be a little obsolete right now, that it hasn't probably pushed the tech companies enough. And the media enough to have to follow certain kinds of rules. The pushback against the Sandy Hook situation, right, with this kind of creating a terror in people's lives out of this false flag narrative that you mentioned, that's a good step in the right direction. But Europe is certainly experimenting more with holding tech companies responsible for content that leads to harm, for trying to weed out information and not leaving it entirely up to, say, Facebook to regulate itself.
What about governments, though?
Yeah, governments themselves. And France is experimenting with, you know, actually removing misinformation and lead up to elections. There are risks. There are certainly risks to free speech, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't have sort of a good technical answer for you. But I think we would do well to, in some ways, question a little bit more our commitment to the idea that truth just emerges out of a kind of open marketplace. The marketplace of the early 20th century, when that phrase was coined, is really different from the marketplace of today. If we started with a kind of information poor world, which is really where the First Amendment comes out of, one where you want to make sure everything gets heard because there aren't that many things to say, we're now in a world where the opposite is true. There are just too many voices. Nobody can make head or tail of it all. So I do think we will need to kind of come back to this, I would call it free speech absolutism, and ask whether there isn't more that we can do. And I think that is something that's being tried out elsewhere, which, because the culture of free speech is a little different in other democracies, Latin American democracies and European ones.
Chris says, getting as much education as possible is the best way to tell what's true and what's not. We need to develop better critical thinking skills. Benjamin says, isn't the main problem the fact that people could hear a truth and just ignore it because it doesn't fit into their desired narrative? Something we'd mentioned earlier.
Yes. Both really important points. So on the first one, on education, yes, education, K to 12 and higher education, need to be teaching, I think, two different sets of skills that might sound like they're at opposition, but I don't really think they are. One is, how do you get to truth in different ways? How do scientists get to truth? How do people in history, for instance, get to truth? How do we know anything? But also teaching what's skepticism that's valuable skepticism, the questioning of official verities, as opposed to just disbelieving everything you ever hear. So I think both of those are critical to be built into education. I taught a history of truth course this past year at the University of Pennsylvania, and it was tremendous fun. The students just had so much to say, and because I think it's on everyone's mind, and no one's really sure what to do about it. And these were students from a wide variety of disciplines, and it was really terrific, fun, and important. On the question of confirmation bias, yes, but that's a permanent sort of feature of human psychology, I think. And part of that education could be trying to help people see how they need to fight their own confirmation biases all the time.
Question your own assumptions.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
Well, Sophia Rosenfeld, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Well, thank you. This has been a real pleasure.
Pleasure for us as well. And the book is called Democracy and Truth, A Short History. And again, she's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.